Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the play Collected Stories, and we'll be hearing from Wild Earth Guardians. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Tulku Sangnyak Rinpoche. I'd also like to welcome Dr. Georgia Milan and translator Richard Barron. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you were here, Rinpoche, last year, and we talked at great length about Tibetan Buddhism and the philosophy of Tibetan Buddhism. And at that time, you were on your way to Santa Fe to start a Buddhist center. Has that come to fruition?
Yes, in the interim, we've not only started a center in Santa Fe, but we've also acquired retreat land a short distance from the city. And in fact, while I'm here today, I'm actually in the middle of leading a retreat program for about 20-odd people out at the retreat land.
Tell us your own story. You were born and raised in Tibet. Did you follow Buddhist practice from an early age? Were you always destined to become a teacher?
In my own case, before I was able to make my own mind up about anything, that is to say when I was about 2 or 3 years old, I was formally recognized as what is called a tulku in the Tibetan system, which means an incarnate who is recognized as the re-embodiment of someone from a past lifetime. To be truthful, I don't even really remember that occasion. I was so young.
And where did it go from there?
Shortly after my enthronement, shall we say, the recognition of my status as a tulku, the Chinese communist forces invaded my area of Tibet, and there was the military occupation that began, which meant that a lot of the traditional way of life was destroyed. The monasteries were emptied, in many cases destroyed, and the whole basis of our society was really turned on its head by the way the Chinese occupiers were enforcing their policies. So up until the age of about 14, I lived a pretty simple life. I took care of the herds the family had, helped with the crops and so forth. And I was able to study Buddhism, but very much in secret. You weren't able to do this in any public way or way that people would know about. So my father and a couple of others served as my tutors and trained me in the Buddhist teachings as best they could. But again, it all had to be done very much on the quiet. Now, because of my status, shall we say, the role that I served in traditional Tibetan culture, even though it was now against the official policy of the occupying forces, people still really looked to me with a lot of hope and a sense of inspiration as somebody who would be a teacher and a leader among them, even though I was still quite young. So up until the age of about 13 or 14, I tried to help people as best I could with what I was learning through the Buddhist teachings, but often it had to be done at night, very much in quiet and in a very covert way. Then there came a time around the time that I was 14, there came a time in China itself where there was a lot of internal political upheaval. And their attention was not so much on what was going on in Tibet, and so we felt a little more confident in being more open in conducting our ceremonies and having public teachings and so forth. The problem is that when the Chinese settled their internal problems, they turned with even more force on Tibet, and at the age of 14 I was thrown into prison because of my role as a Buddhist teacher, and I spent the next 9 years of my life in a prison.
What was that like? What were your days like? How did they treat you?
When I was first taken to the prison, there was a period of what I would think they would probably call re-education, which involved people grilling me, interrogating me. I was beaten on occasion. I still don't have the completely full use of one of my arms because of the treatment I received. And all that was by way of determining how much it would be possible to change my mind and bring it into line with their policies, and also to determine how serious a threat I seemed and so what kind of sentence I should be given. But once I'd been sentenced to what I was finally required to serve in terms of years in prison, after that, things quieted down, settled down. I wasn't really mistreated in any overt way. I had to do a lot of hard work. During the time that I was in the prison system there, I was moved on 3 separate occasions. So I actually spent time in 3 different prisons. And by and large, my work would consist of things like cutting wood in the forest or helping to lay roads, a lot of physical labor. So on a daily basis, that was my routine.
Were you with other Tibetans?
Yes, very many. Thousands of others.
Were you able to support each other and keep up your practices and your culture, even within the prison camp?
I could really only speak for myself, but in my case, what I found was ironic, even, was the fact that when I was put into prison as a young boy, I found myself in prison with some of the finest teachers and scholars of the Buddhist tradition that I otherwise might not have met.
Exactly. That's what I was wondering.
Because the communists focused upon the people who had a religious role in the society as the people they cleaned up first and put into prison. So if I had been left outside the prison on my own as a young boy, I probably would never have found a teacher. And who knows what I might or might not know now. But the fact that I was put into a prison where there were such fine teachers and I was able to have daily access to them was, from my perspective, enormously helpful. Now, again, we still had to do this very much in secret because the prison guards and the wardens and so forth wouldn't have allowed it if they'd known. But we were able, in a covert way, to carry on a process whereby I was able to receive a fairly extensive education from these teachers.
I was going to ask you whether the teaching that you had had up until that point, before you were 14, mm-hmm. helped you to survive. But now I'm wondering whether it was the other teachers that you had there who helped you to survive.
In my own case, it was the latter situation. Up until the time I went into prison, while I had a basic confidence in and respect for the Buddhist tradition that I was raised in and knew a little bit about the rituals and ceremonies, in terms of any real inner spiritual practice, I really gained the ability to pursue that in prison.
This may be I don't mean this to sound like a disrespectful question, but is prison in some ways a good place for that kind of learning?
That really depends upon the individual's opportunities. If you're able to, as I was, find and rely on a spiritual teacher and practice, however secretly, in a prison, then I think it did provide me with an ideal situation. But we can't pretend that being in prison is anything but an unpleasant experience. In fact, for many people, it was like hell on earth. It was a terrible experience. My own situation was one where I received enormous kindness from my teachers and guidance in practice that really made me feel, by the end of my sentence, I felt I wasn't in prison, I was in a retreat center.
Well, I ask this because I've known Buddhist teachers who teach prisoners here in the United States, and mm-hmm. I've also seen some documentaries about that, mm-hmm. and it seems that prisoners take to the practice so beautifully, mm-hmm. I think partly because they are desperate, and partly because they have the time, and partly because they need that discipline.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I certainly agree with you. I think that's very true. And certainly in my own case, that was what happened. I had the opportunity, I had the time, and I had the real impetus to practice.
So how did you get out, and what happened after that?
My first sentence was for 5 years. But because of the existing political situation, by the time my sentence was up, they extended it another 4. And it might have gone on longer, but Chairman Mao Zedong died at that point, and then there was a whole shift in the way the policies of the central government were being carried out in Tibet. So there was really a kind of blanket amnesty for anybody who had been imprisoned purely for religious reasons. If it was a political or a criminal case, that was another thing. But in my case, because I had only been imprisoned for being a religious teacher, I was one of the many who were released. So I was let off basically with a clean record, so to speak, because they considered, okay, that was the past, we're not holding you anymore, and they just let me go.
And where did you go?
In my own case, when I was released from prison, it was in central Tibet, somewhat near to the capital of Lhasa, and at the same time my teacher was released. And so my teacher said, rather than go back to my home area in eastern Tibet, which was quite a distance, that maybe it would be better for me and others like me of a younger age to think about escaping and going to India, going into exile as refugees. And so I went with my teacher to Lhasa, to the capital, and we spent about a year there. And while I was there, I did pilgrimage to some of the holy places and received more teachings and met some other teachers. And all the while, we were kind of planning what would be necessary to make that escape and go off as a refugee to India.
Once you got into India, what did you do then?
I didn't actually go directly to India because between the Indian border, the northern Indian border, and the southern Tibetan border, there are two countries, Nepal and Bhutan. And by and large, when you leave Tibet by the southern route, you go through one or the other of those countries. And in my case, it was to Bhutan. And when I arrived in Bhutan, I met the teacher who would become my teacher at that point, my main teacher, whose name was Dingo Chensi Rinpoche. And he took charge of me to educate me and train me further. And so I started following him as an attendant and student, and that took me to India and Nepal and other places. And eventually, Chensi Rinpoche established his monastery, which is still in Kathmandu in Nepal. And so because he was there most of the time, I was there too. And I was serving him as an attendant, receiving teachings from him, and also helping with the monastery. As my skills and training developed, I was able to be a teacher in my own right, to lead rituals and so forth. And so to the best of my ability, I served my teacher and received teachings from him, and then also tried to help out with the running of the monastery. And that was for a period of 14 years.
And these were all Tibetan exiles?
Yes. The core population were Tibetan refugees, but there were other people from Nepal and Bhutan who would come to the monastery, take ordination, and become part of the community.
To what extent has Tibetan religious culture truly survived in its new countries, particularly Nepal and Bhutan and India and so on, and what's been lost?
Initially, of course, Tibet underwent such a shock due to the military occupation that a great deal of the tradition was, if not lost, at least severely impacted. And we have to say, of course, there are some things that have probably been lost forever. But due to the really remarkable efforts of some very dedicated teachers and lamas in exile in Nepal and Bhutan and India, there's been a lot of effort put into preserving and restoring whatever they could. And I can say with confidence that they've done a wonderful job and that a great deal of the traditional religious culture has been preserved, although certainly something has been lost. Particularly due to the inspiring leadership of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the fact that he was able to come out of Tibet and run the government in exile and direct a lot of projects to preserve both the religious and secular culture of Tibet, that has made an enormous difference.
Now, there are many Tibetan exiles here in the United States who are keeping up as best they can their cultures and language and religion and so on, and yet bringing a culture like that to the United States, which is so profoundly different and so much oriented toward the individual. Mm-hmm. It must be hard for the younger generations to grow up with the depth of understanding that you did.
I think you're right. The fact that the younger generations of Tibetans who are born and growing up, who have been born and are growing up in the United States, the education system they're going through and so forth, and the kind of cultural values they're being taught, is really, in some ways, an impediment to them preserving their traditional culture. And this is why His Holiness the Dalai Lama speaks a great deal on this subject these days. He's very much trying to encourage the younger generations of Tibetans to hold on to their culture. Many of them are making an effort to do so, but realistically speaking, we will have to say that over time, probably a lot of that will be lost.
I mean, I suppose that they'd have to travel, if not to Tibet, to somewhere in Asia, in the Eastern Hemisphere, to get a taste of it in a more visceral way.
Now, here in Santa Fe, we do have a Tibetan association that has acquired a building and has established a program for the teaching of Tibetan language and culture to the newer generation. And so they have weekend programs when the children can come and learn their native language. And also, people in the Tibetan community take turns leading ceremonies and holding events. So here, things are actually going pretty well. There's a lot of effort put into helping to maintain the culture. In other areas, that's not the case. It really depends on the individuals in the area coming together as a group. Unfortunately, I have seen many cases nowadays where there are younger Tibetans who don't know a word of their native language and don't know anything about their traditional culture because they've grown up completely in America as Americans and have no sense of any connection with that, with their past. So that is a shame, and I've seen a lot of it.
How did you end up in the United States?
Before my teacher, Chenzi Rinpoche, passed away, he told me that one of the things I should seriously consider was a project to establish my own monastic institution with a meditation center. And so I already had this plan in mind. And in fact, I have been able in Nepal to establish a nunnery so that Tibetan women, young Tibetan women, have an opportunity to study and practice, and also a retreat center and a monastic institution as well for the men. That is all in Nepal, but I found that staying simply in Nepal and trying to raise the necessary funds and materials to carry out such a project was difficult. And so I appealed to one of my fellow Tibetan teachers, a teacher named Chögde Tulku Rinpoche, who was already living in the United States, for help. And he said, well, we're not a wealthy organization ourselves. It's not as though we could support you. You know what would be a good idea, he said, would be for you to come to the United States and teach here yourself. And in a certain sense, I suppose he was encouraging me to go international, to sort of have a base outside of Nepal in the West. And so that was what brought me for the first time to the United States, was the invitation of Chögde Tulku.
And do you find yourself teaching mostly Americans here in this country, or are you teaching a whole international community?
In fact, I have really gone international, I suppose I should say, because about half of my time now is spent in the United States, and the other half is in various countries, largely in Nepal, where I spend 2 or 3 months a year teaching at my monastery and the nunnery and the retreat center. I also go every year to Bhutan and to India, to places like Taiwan and Hong Kong, where the Chinese populations are very interested in the Buddhist teachings. So about half the year I spend going to these other places, and about half the time I'm in the United States.
So you are now working on a project which is called the Garden of 1,000 Buddhas. What's that all about?
After I came to the United States and began teaching here, at a certain point, circumstances brought me to Montana, and we established a center there, which we still have in Arley, which is close to Missoula. And at a certain point, I started to think of the fact that the world is facing so many problems these days. From a Buddhist perspective, the way we would say it traditionally would be that the world is lacking in merit, because there is so much war, so much strife, so many problems that we see around us. So one has to make an effort oneself to do something. But you can't do very much on your own. You need to kind of galvanize people and bring them together to do something positive. So I began to think of some project that would bring about something of an enormous benefit, some enormously meritorious project. And I've been very struck by some of the more profound teachings of the Buddhist path, which speak of what they refer to as the Great Mother, which is a way of personifying wisdom and seeing wisdom as the source of enlightenment. And so the way this teaching, which is known as the Heart Sutra, is the core of these teachings, the way in which these teachings speak about it is that the Great Mother is the mother of all the Buddhas. She is the wisdom that brings about enlightenment in all of us. So I thought to myself, wouldn't it be wonderful to have an environment where there was a statue representing the Great Mother, surrounded by the statues of the 1,000 Buddhas that the teachings of Buddhism say will appear in this age, and 1,000 stupas, which are monuments that represent architecturally all of the qualities of the enlightened state of mind. Now, of course, perhaps I was being somewhat naive. I didn't think of the scale of project I was planning. I just thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had this? And so not even thinking of how much is it going to cost, where are we going to get the material, where are we going to get these statues, I just embarked on this project. I just announced to my students, I thought, this is what we should do. We soon found out it was a lot harder in the execution than it was in the planning, because it has proved to be quite an undertaking. But we're still at it.
So this project is going on in Montana, and we have Dr. Georgia Milan here. You are very much involved with this project. What is your role?
I'm one of the people involved with this project, and I was there at the very inception, and it's a very vast project, and Rinpoche is right. His vision is so vast, and this is a rural part of Montana with not that many people, and it took us probably 3 or 4 years to build 3 Buddha statues. And so we got off to a very slow start.
Who's building them?
Us people in the Sangha. And it's amazing because these are 1,000 Buddha statues.
I mean.
Well, we have a mold that Rinpoche brought back from Nepal, and we can cast about 20 or 30 Buddha statues from each mold, so we have to keep making more molds. And each Buddha statue takes about a month to make. They're approximately 2 feet high and in just incredible detail. And so after you get them out of the mold, then you have to refine them all through Dremeling so there's no imperfections, and then they have to be sealed. So it's a huge, huge project.
It sounds like it's maybe part of a, I don't know, meditative practice all by itself.
Yes, it definitely is, and we have to keep thinking of it that way. And it's such an honor to be involved in it, and at times we do feel a little overwhelmed, but the majority of the time we feel that we've probably waited many, many lifetimes to be involved in something that will bring about such change in the world. And we have had people from all over the world who will show up and ask if they can help build a statue. And the central statue of Yum Chenmo is an amazing preservation of Tibetan art and culture. And we had one of the finest artists from Nepal, Lama Sonam, who's been there every year working on her. And she does awaken incredible wisdom in anyone who gazes on her. And the whole layout of the garden, it's laid out in the form
of a... The statue makes you wise?
It makes just looking at the statue awakens something in you that makes you feel like a better person when you leave. It's amazing. We have so many visitors in the summer. We'll have hundreds of them that come to this rural area of Montana. And I remember last summer this woman in a wheelchair came, and she was dying. She was not a Buddhist, and she gazed on Yum Chenmo. And she left, and a week later, her dying wish was that she be brought back to gaze upon Yum Chenmo one more time. So she was brought back again with many attendants, gazed on Yum Chenmo, and then left and died that night, and reportedly died very happy. We have busloads of people come, old people, you know, with their oxygen masks on, and they go into the barn where we have almost 1,000 Buddhas stored right now, waiting to bring them out, and they will fall on their knees and just cry. It's amazing the transformation, and in our Buddhist belief, it's that sense of everyone's innate purity, everyone's Buddha nature is awakened just on gazing on one of these statues. And we have so many of them. So all of the Buddha statues are handmade in Montana, and the stupas, which just arrived last week, were hand-carved in Indonesia.
So you are, the land that you're on there in Montana is, it's Indian land, but it's one of those Indian reservations where non-Indians are able to buy land. What is your relationship like with the local Indians?
Right, that's a very good question. We are very... sensitive to the fact that the Garden of 1,000 Buddhas is on indigenous land. And the Flathead Reservation, which has the Salish, Kootenai, and Pendere people, 100 years ago was open for homesteading. And so it's a reservation that is referred to as checkerboarded, that in fact the majority of the land is owned by non-natives. And Rinpoche recognized the land when he saw it as the land of the Garden of 1,000 Buddhas. And so he immediately did meet with elders in the tribe who took part in ceremonies in order to purify the land. And one of the reasons that the Garden of 1,000 Buddhas is on that land is because it is very sacred land. It has been held in the hearts and the minds of the people for many, many, many generations. And so every year we have a peace festival, and an integral part of that peace festival is inviting the Native Americans to tell their story, to talk about peace, compassion, and the land. Rinpoche has met with the tribal council, and many tears were shed as the stories of the indigenous people were shared. and cultures that are on the brink of extinction and what we have to lose, which is really everything. You know, the indigenous knowledge is really our hope for the future. And so the indigenous Tibetans very much have a lot in common with the Native Americans. And so as we look at continuing the garden, it's continuing building the relationships with people all over the world, but with the Native Americans. His Holiness the Dalai Lama had asked Rinpoche if he could come and consecrate the garden. And a big part of that would be a gathering of tribal members from all over the Americas to meet with His Holiness to discuss the different cultures.
Is that going to happen?
That's what the plan is. We don't have a date, but that's what the plan is. And
excellent.
All I know is that working with Rinpoche, his plans seem to come to fruition. So, yes, I expect that is going to happen.
The question of what brings a person wisdom is something that I find fascinating. It's something that I wanted to ask Rinpoche. I mean, you can look at a statue, and that's nice, but I thought that wisdom comes from practice, teaching, patience, and an internal process, which is basically not something that you can get in a few minutes or get by looking at something.
What you say is right, of course, that developing wisdom is something you gain through your own experience internally, but what Georgia was referring to is the fact that there can be situations, and in fact we need often in our lives something that happens to us or some situation we find ourselves in that really brings about a change of mind, a change of heart. Something shifts for us, and then we're not satisfied until we've explored further, until we've really gone into that process for ourselves. So you might think of it as like a seed in you that needs to be watered, and once it's watered, it starts growing inside you. So in the case of the kind of liberation and inspiration that comes upon seeing something like the statue, it's simply that serves as a special kind of support for people. When they see it, it brings about a change in their way of thinking. They feel inspired, they feel joyful, they feel intrigued. They want to go further with whatever it is they've sensed from that. For example, the most holy place in the world for Buddhists is Bodh Gaya in India, where the Buddha is held to have attained enlightenment some 2,500 years ago. People come from all over the world. And in the case of many Buddhists, it's their life's goal to get there. And when they get there, they find themselves being tremendously inspired, and they feel they want to go further. They want to take it further. And so they'll come to Bodh Gaya, they'll make offerings on the shrine, they'll make prayers for their own and others' benefit, and then they'll go away with a sense of, that was wonderful, that really changed my life, now I want to do something about it, I want to go further. So it's a question of circumstances helping us not to continue to remain asleep, but waking us up, reminding us that we need to wake up.
And then if they want to go further, they can go to your retreat center.
That's certainly one thing I'm very interested in, is giving people the opportunity to pursue their study and practice, to give them the opportunity to study and learn and then undertake personal retreats of a shorter duration or perhaps years in some cases. But that's certainly one aspect of what I am trying to do. So what I see myself doing is contributing to a much bigger picture where there are many teachers out there who are trying to do the same thing, to give people who want to go further with their spiritual development an opportunity to do so.
There is a fundraiser coming up for the Garden of 1,000 Buddhas, and maybe, Georgia, you can just tell us the whens and wheres of that.
Excellent. Yes. Everyone, please come. The fundraiser is going to be Saturday, October 1st. It's from 6 to 9, and it's at the Zane Bennett Gallery. That's at 435 South Guadalupe. There's going to be a live auction with incredible items. I mean, there will be the handmade Buddha statues from Montana.
You're selling them?
Well, there will be one of them auctioned off at the live auction.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, these are invaluable, and we will tell you much more of the story behind these Buddhas at the auction. So there will be other wonderful Tibetan articles in the live auction and the silent auction. There's going to be music by a wonderful Tibetan artist named Pemsi, and there's a wonderful band from Hawaii that's going to be playing. There's going to be momos, the traditional food of Tibet, wonderful things to drink. We're going to have a wonderful time. I'll tell you what, the Tibetan Buddhists know how to have a very, very good time. that makes us work very, very hard. So please join us. It's going to be fun. I do want to say that This place in Montana and Santa Fe, it's not a coincidence that Tukusanya Grimpeche has resided in both of these areas. They're very, very similar, and we feel very much they are sister areas. And so to support the Garden of a Thousand Buddhas in Montana is supporting the same energy here in Santa Fe. So please come.
And by the way, the website for Rinpoche's Meditation Center here in Santa Fe is ewam.org. That's ewam.org. And you also have weekly meditation practices?
Yes, at Pema Khandro Ling, which is on Louisa Street, there are weekly meditation practices every Thursday at 7 p.m. And it's for people who know nothing about meditation or very experienced meditators. Please come. It's open to everyone.
And also, the website for the Garden of a Thousand Buddhas is ewambuddhagarden.org. That is ewambuddhagarden.org. Dr. Georgia Milan and Tulku Sangnak Rinpoche and translator Richard Barron, thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Brad Fairbanks. He's director of the play Collected Stories, which opens at the Santa Fe Playhouse tonight. And Lois Viscoli and Vanessa Rios Ivalles, actors in this play, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
So this is a play about two writers, a young writer at the beginning of her career, an older writer more at the end of her career, and the relationship between them. How would you set up the story, Brad? I mean, one of them is rising and one of them is setting, to use a sunset metaphor.
That's a perfect way to start the description of it. She's actually still in school, and it starts with her tutorial with the mentor, or the person that's going to become her mentor. And she is learning. She's already got some skills at writing, but she's learning from the best. And then she becomes her assistant. And in that develops this relationship that goes beyond just, you know, teacher-student. And that's where the play unfolds from there.
And so this relationship between mentor and student, between great writer and assistant, and that writer trying to find her voice is a very interesting one. And, I mean, both of you are actors. I wondered if it had any parallel to your lives as students of another art form, namely theater.
Well, I've personally never had a mentor in theater, so nothing for me. It actually more parallels my day job in real estate, where I'm being mentored by, you know, my boss, a real estate agent.
Right.
I certainly understand that sort of pressure to learn from somebody, but then also need to get out from under the influence and go off on your own.
Right. What about you, Lois? Have you been in the position of mentor?
I have been a mentor. I've been a teacher. I taught at the penitentiary for 10 years, and I had a lot of students that were extremely interesting, to say the least. And I realized, and I think it relates to this play as well, the importance of influence and who influences who, actually, and how much the person who is supposedly influencing the young person is really being influenced by the younger people, by their questions and what they're talking about.
There's an interesting set of questions that arise during this play, I think, about the borderlines between fiction and autobiography, or fiction and biography. And I guess it raised the question for me, is there such a thing as really, really as fiction, especially for a young writer?
That is a good question. It depends on, I suppose, what it comes under, if it's called fiction or if it's a memoir. Or most books, especially first books, I think, are autobiographical for the most part, because you do basically write about what you know about, which I think occurs in this play. And this is one of the, I won't say problems, but one of the ongoing themes of the play.
Brad, how did you get involved with directing this play?
Well, I was in an acting class with both Vanessa and Lois, and that's where we met, and we bonded quite quickly, and Lois called me up and said, hey, Brad, would you like to direct this play, Collected Stories? She's giving me some signals
now. No, the Playhouse was very eager about that as well. They were very fond of that idea.
Well, then she said you have to make a proposal, of course,
to the Playhouse.
And the Playhouse said we would love to have Lois and Vanessa. And that's how it all began.
And we're thrilled, of course, to have Brad, because we knew him from this acting class that we all took. And so we formed this friendship and this desire to do something, the three of us. And
now, you're fairly new in town, Brad?
I'm actually not, but I've been hiding a little bit, if you might say, as far as the theater outside of school goes.
Oh, okay.
So this is, since I've moved to Santa Fe, it's been 9 years. This is my first directorial debut outside of a high school. So I'm not really new to Santa Fe, but I moved here from Manhattan 9 years ago and started the acting class probably 2 years ago, and it's been unbelievable thrill for me to be directing these two, just because they're wonderful actresses and they catch on, take direction extremely well, and they also know their craft well enough. I was going back to your original question. I think writing and the autobiography is a lot like acting, where, of course, you're playing a character, but you still bring a lot of yourself to that character, and these guys do that better than most. For sure.
Oh, thank you.
Well, the two writers, they're interesting characters. And I went home last night and somebody was asking me about the play. And my comment that came out of my mouth without even thinking about it was, writers aren't very nice people.
Well, they may be somewhat like sponges, I think. They take in everything around them, and how that comes out can sometimes not always be positive. Sometimes there's a negativity involved with that.
You never know if you're going to end up in one of their stories and as a character in one of their stories, and if what the writer has to say about you is something that you would appreciate.
Right, and if you're a good writer, you can't sit around worrying about what they're going to think.
Exactly.
Yeah. And with a play like this, you can't give away too much of it, because it's just an ensemble piece. These two people, these two characters,
right,
all taking place within the apartment of one of them, of the character Ruth Steiner, whom you play, Lois. Brad, what can you tell us about the playwright, Donald Margulies?
Well, he's done other pieces, Sight Unseen for one. But what I like about him, he's very contemporary. This show was on Broadway 2 or 3 years ago.
Yes, it was.
It's been done with Linda Gavin in the older part and Uta Hagen. Right,
and
Lois?
Uta Hagen played it as well.
Yeah.
But some time ago, I think, right, 10 years ago. I'm not sure.
So it's a piece that's extremely entertaining, very fresh, very new. It takes place in the present time. And it's also interesting how it breaks down with the different scenes and the passage of time, which Donald does quite well. The play takes place over 6 years, which allows these guys to develop relationships that may go deeper than something that happens in 2 hours. And it's also quite what brings the great challenge as a director and actor for these guys to show a progression of character over so much time within the relationship.
There's definitely an arc to both characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
The way they start out and their relationship, and of course the way it evolves and ends. And all of that is fascinating as an actor to work with, because you don't just have a stereotypical kind of character to play. You have somebody who changes and is influenced by the other character in the play.
And especially with Lisa, Vanessa's character, to watch her go from a student in grad school to,
well,
without
nervous,
giving the end, right.
Right, very very sort of juvenile, and to grow into her confidence and
as a person and a writer.
As a person and as a writer, exactly.
And I am not going to give it away, but you were left with real questions,
right,
at the end.
Yes.
Which I think, I mean, everybody who goes and sees this play should then go have coffee with,
yes,
whoever they,
yes,
went with.
That's
absolutely
our goal.
Absolutely.
And talk about it.
I mean, that's the number one goal, is
exactly
to get people talking. Who do you side with? Which one do you agree with? Or did you think her point of view was, because they're, as I said earlier, or I've always thought that the point of view of both of them are so strong that you kind of left thinking, well,
right,
they both make a lot of sense.
Right,
yeah,
right, right. Mm-hmm. The play is called Collected Stories, and the preview opening is tonight at the Santa Fe Playhouse, and it runs through the 16th of August, Thursday through Saturdays at 8 in the evening, Sundays at 2 in the afternoon. For tickets, you can go to santafeplayhouse.org, or you can call 988 4262. And Brad Fairbanks is the director. Lois Viscoli and Vanessa Rios Ivalles are the actors in the play. And by the way, the opening gala is tomorrow night, September 30th. And so people can check that out as well. Thank you all for being here.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you. It's our pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And we've got a few minutes left in the program today. I want to introduce Carol Norton. She is back with us. She is with Wild Earth Guardians. And Jeff Keenan with Who's Donuts, which is just opening tonight. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for having us.
So what's going on, Carol? You were on recently for a little bit. You've got the big Wild Earth Gala this Friday night.
We do have the Wild Earth Gala on Friday, and we would love for people to join us. It's going to be at the Convention Center this year because we've outgrown Bishop's Lodge, and we're going to be celebrating the Rio Grande. And we have a new book, which I hope folks will see. We're going to do more on that in a couple of weeks, but it's done, it's out, and it's available.
The Rio Grande, An Eagle's View, a wonderful book, and I hope to be talking with the author one of these days soon. So you'll be celebrating the publication of this book and the river itself.
That's right. It's a really great night, lots of schmoozing, great vegan dinner, live auction.
Vegan dinner?
Vegan dinner.
Uh-oh.
Full on. We're committed. We're your people.
And just tell us a little bit about the efforts to, some of the problems that are happening in the river these days and the efforts to solve those problems and save the river.
Well, that's exactly the point of the book, is to raise awareness of the Rio Grande. The biggest problem is that there's not enough water for everybody, and there certainly hasn't been enough water for the river. So the river in 1996 actually went dry, and it really catalyzed Wild Earth Guardians to begin to work on water issues.
And what happened? I mean, one of the things, we had Flip Nicklin on last week, and we were talking about whales, and it's encouraging that every once in a while there are these stories of, for example, whale populations bouncing back and dry rivers getting wet again.
You know, that can happen. It's an absolute possibility, but it's not going to happen by ignoring the problem. So we are doing a lot of work in different areas. The number one thing we're trying to do is a water leasing program where we buy water back from farmers and put it in the river, giving the river a right to its own water.
Very interesting. So water rights for the river as opposed to people who are taking it out of the river.
That's right, and we're buying them so the farmers can then go to a different kind of system that's more efficient, uses less water, so they can take the money and put in a drip system, for
different
instance.
Kinds of irrigation. Brilliant.
Yes, we think so too. Win-win for everybody. And there are, I forget how many species who depend on the Rio Grande, hundreds indirectly for sure. And so species like the silvery minnow, the willow flycatcher, even more species all will have a place that they can call home.
Now, you've got something called Stream Team.
That's right. So the other thing we do besides policy work trying to protect and advocate for our river is we actually go out and restore it. We plant hundreds of thousands of trees, 100,000 this year, mostly willow, quite a few, maybe 5,000, 10,000 cottonwoods, some forage trees as well so that the different species, particularly bird, have something to eat. And we restore whole stretches of streams.
And if people want to see what this looks like, they can go on the Wild Earth Guardians website, and there are some before and after pictures.
It's phenomenal.
It's unbelievable.
It's such a visceral experience because we actually go in and take out all the non-natives, which brings it down to zero.
So you've got a bunch of yellow dirt, basically.
Lovely yellow, red, purple dirt. And then we come back and build it back up. So we'll dig holes. Some of the holes are 8 to 12 feet deep. We plant cottonwood poles, which are sometimes 20 feet tall, and at the end of the day, you're in a forest of beauty.
Amazing, amazing. So people can join the Stream Team and just hang out with the Wild Earth Guardians and plant trees. And
that's right, and what's great this year is we did a lot of our work up in the Valle Caldera, which, as a lot of people know, is up for grabs at the moment. It's hard to tell whether it's going to stay with the Forest Service or go into the National Park Service, and it is a beautiful place. The fires that went through this year actually were beneficial So not in every on every acre, but in many of the acres. And
that's interesting, because in some places they were very, very harmful to the earth.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's that's a bigger problem that we can talk about today.
Yeah.
But the fire does belong in the ecosystem. We can live with fire. The fire in the Valle was primarily a beneficial fire. It's going to restore the ecosystem, and the streams with the planting that we did this spring will come back even faster. We're going to go back this fall and replant in a couple places that burned, refence to keep the elk out so the trees can grow, and just have another couple of really fun days.
Excellent. Now, Jeff Keenan, you are with Who's Donuts? You are also with the Chocolate Smith.
This is true.
And you are opening a new donut shop, and there's a big public opening tonight. What's the relationship between your business and Wild Earth Guardians?
Well, we've always been a supporter of Wild Earth Guardians through the Chocolate Smith over the years. But the connection today is really more to do with the Stream Team and the plantings that they do here in New Mexico. One of my favorite bike rides that I go on is off of Airport Road down past the wastewater treatment plant, where I've been able to see firsthand the amazing regrowth of that stream area with the constant water supply and whatnot. And it just had us thinking that how can we start our new business, the Who's Donut Shop, and integrate some contribute to an organization that's planting like this. So what we did is we sat down with Carol Norton and we came up with an idea called Three for the Trees, where we're going to have 3 cents from every donut that we sell basically go as a contribution towards the tree planting that they do here in New Mexico.
Nice. Now, Who's Donut Shop, your logo is an owl that says who. And what's different about this shop? I mean, do you have some of those wild and crazy kinds of donuts that they have in the big cities?
Yeah, we're definitely going to try to attract some new, fun things. We'll have all the classics, and we'll have some twists on the modern classics. So really, you'll see things in our donut shop that you would find in New York or San Francisco, and hopefully we'll find a home for them here in New Mexico.
What are some of your favorites?
Let's see. Right now, it would be a lemon cake donut with a vanilla glaze and pistachio on top. Or one that we already know is going to be a big hit is the maple chili bacon donut, which is not necessarily vegan friendly, but it'll be one of the more popular items.
They will be not be serving it at the Wild Earth Gala.
But everything that we're going to do is all handmade, all from scratch, all organic ingredients, as many local items that we can source. So really, we're trying to go forward with a good model for what we're doing.
And that's tonight. Where is the shop?
The shop's at 851 B Cerrillos Road, right next to the Chocolate Smith.
Oh, okay.
Our open house event's going to be on from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. We're going to give away thousands of donuts, and anyone and everyone is welcome to come. So bring your friends and come get a first look at what we're going to do before we open Friday morning.
And Wild Earth Guardians is on the web at wildearthguardians.org. You can go to events and find the gala for Friday night. Is there a phone number you want to give?
505-988-9126, extension 0. And I'll meet you at 6 a.m. at Who's Donuts on Friday.
6 a.m.
Yes, because I know you are.
A morning person. Carol Norton is with Wild Earth Guardians. Jeff Keenan is with Who's Donuts and the Chocolate Smith. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.